I read that your first high school game was in your senior year. You led your Spartans team to a 67-52 win. And in that game, you had 23 points and 12 rebounds. The article that I read said that you only played half the game, which is remarkable. But prior to that, you hadn't played a minute of varsity hoops. What do you actually remember either about the first game you played or just that senior year at high school, Steve?
The starting senior was a senior, and the coach was going to bring me along slowly. He put me in the game, and the rest is history.
That's an incredible stat line for your first game of organized hoops. You certainly jumped in and made a massive impact immediately.
And you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Takes it off and there's number 23. And, of course, Johnny goes nuts.
So we're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Grant, you make the pass. Yes. Christian, can you catch the ball? Yes.
All the stars were aligned and all the muscles fired at the right time. And I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 111. Thanks for joining me. I'm excited to welcome Oregon State University star, State of Oregon Hall of Famer, NBA All-Star, and 10-year veteran Steve Johnson. This is an enlightening chat about Steve's unique rise from high school to the NBA. He truly took a path that very few pro players ever have. Steve's a great storyteller, and the conversation features numerous laughs, plus a fantastic story about Steve, Michael Jordan, and Lakeshore Drive, Chicago. Towards the end of the episode, I'll share another great podcast review. If you can spare a moment or two, please add your review via your listening app. It'd be most appreciated. Show notes for this episode and access to a huge archive of past episodes are available at inallairness.com. This conversation was recorded before the Last Dance docuseries premiered in April 2020. Now, onto the show. My guest today had a unique journey from high school to the pros. He ranks second, only to Gary Payton, in career scoring at Oregon State University. He's a 10-year NBA veteran and was named an All-Star in 1988. Steve Johnson, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Appreciate you making time to talk with me today, and I'm excited to chat about your career. Just before we get into your life in basketball, what sports or hobbies did you enjoy when you were a youngster?
I didn't, because I didn't play organized sports till my senior year. So I didn't do any sports or any hobbies or anything growing up.
I did read an intriguing article about you that was published in 1976. And just for some quick context for our listener, it suggested that the summer after your junior year of high school, you literally ran away from home due to a combination of religious beliefs and restrictions that the school you had been attending was putting on you. If it's not too personal, if you don't mind my asking, how difficult was that decision that ultimately set you on a path to the NBA?
It's not difficult at all. I've told the runaway story many times. It was actually my parents who objected to me playing basketball. I grew up Seventh-day Adventist, and Seventh-day Adventist, the holy day is sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. Half the high school games are played on Friday nights. My parents would not allow me to transfer to public school to play. So before my senior year, I ran away from home for the last time.
That's quite remarkable. Now, you're 6'10". At what age did you begin to really stand out height-wise above all your peers, or were you always a tall boy?
Well, I was always one of the tallest kids in the classroom, and the height really didn't become an issue in high school because I didn't play any sports. So I was just a tall guy. And when I first started playing basketball in ninth grade, I was just playing on the playgrounds, but I didn't play any organized basketball.
You played at San Gorgonio High School?
San Gorgonio, yes. San G.
San G. Okay, we'll call it San G. And you're led by Coach John Powell. Now, I read that your first high school game was in your senior year, as you mentioned, and you led your Spartans team to a 67-52 win. And in that game, you had 23 points and 12 rebounds. The article that I read said that you only played half the game, which is remarkable. But prior to that, you hadn't played a minute of varsity hoops. What do you actually remember either about the first game you played or just that senior year at high school, Steve?
The starting senior was a senior, and the coach was going to bring me along slowly. He put me in the game, and the rest is history.
That's an incredible stat line for your first game of organized hoops. 3 days later, if I read correctly, you again came off the bench, and you had something like 25 points and 18 rebounds in a 30-point win. So you certainly jumped in and made a massive impact immediately. In that season, your Spartans were co-champions of the Citrus Belt League, and you entered the CIF, the 4A finals, with a record of 22-3. In that season, you averaged almost 20 points, 13-plus rebounds, and almost 4 blocks a game, and you were all CBL first team, all CIF second team. Now, I read that your future college coach, Ralph Miller, visited your high school in March of 76. Do you actually remember his visit, and what sort of impact did he have in your ultimate decision to sign with the Beavers?
When I was in ninth grade, my father asked me if I wanted to go drive into L.A. I grew up in San Bernardino, and he said, would I like to drive into L.A. to watch my cousin basketball practice? And so I had never seen organized basketball before. I don't know why he asked me and just me, but he took just me, and we went and watched his practice. And after I saw it for the first time, there was something about it that I was like, okay, this here is for me. The very first time I saw it. So after the practice, he introduced me to his coach. He said, Coach, I want you to meet my cousin, Steve Johnson. He said, Steve, I want you to meet my coach, Ralph Miller. So the first organized basketball I saw, I met my future college coach.
Oh, wow.
The next day, my cousin came out to our house out in San Bernardino, and he took me back out on the basketball court behind our house, and he said, learn the hook shot. It's a non-defendable shot. So from that day forward, I knew that I wanted to play in the NBA. I had 5 goals that I set to get there. No one told me about goal setting, but I knew that I had to achieve these 5 goals. I knew my game was going to be based around the hook shot. So Lou Alcindor became my idol, and I developed my whole game around the hook shot.
That's fantastic to hear. What a great coincidence of sorts, meeting Ralph Miller at that time, who then would go on to be your coach. Speaking of Lou Alcindor, obviously he played at UCLA. That was one of the colleges, I believe, that were strongly trying to recruit you, including USC, Arizona. You were also thinking about Texas as well. How seriously were you considering those schools, or had you already committed to OSU at that stage?
Well, actually, I was only recruited by 6 colleges because no one knew about me. And UCLA and SC did not recruit me. And then also UCLA picked up the 2 top big guys in California. So it wasn't until I started killing them at Oregon State that USC and UCLA caught a lot of grief. Like, how did Johnson get out of California? But since I didn't play prior to that, I wasn't on anybody's radar. So I was recruited by 2 or 3 small schools, 3 larger schools, and it came down to Oregon State and University of Texas. And University of Texas recruited me and my college teammate really, really hard. But what it came down to was the prior year, Texas had the nation's leading scorer on their team, and he was returning, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm no dummy. If I'm not the leading scorer, then I'm passing to that guy. And then Ralph Miller's offense was built around the post player. So it was an easy decision to me to go to Oregon State because I knew that the offense was built around the post player.
It's really a remarkable story. I'm certainly not understating it when I said that you have a unique road to the pros. It's really fascinating. As I was researching, I was really enjoying going down all these little rabbit holes, finding out about your career. I read that between June and August of 1976, you played with a team called Inland in an Olympic Development Basketball League.
Yep.
And in one game versus San Gabriel, you had 32 points, and 28 of those were in the first half. I read that you also led that league with 23 points per game, and you took them to the tournament finals. How important was that experience ahead of your freshman season at OSU?
Well, first of all, that's when UCLA and USC heard about me. And in that league, we should have won that tournament. No one knew who were these guys from the Inland Empire, a bunch of desert rats or whatever. And yeah, I ended up leading the league, and it came down to a really, really bad call that the team that won, we actually had to play 2 games that day. And the other team, they didn't have to play any games. And it came down to the last play, and we got screwed. But that league was when I got on the radar of everybody. But by then, I had already committed to Oregon State.
Thanks for elaborating there. Now, as a freshman with the Beavers, your team went 16-13. And on November the 26th of 1976, you scored 22 points versus Hawaii. And per the OSU media guide, it says that you still own the record for the most points by a freshman in a college debut. You averaged about 13.5 points and 5.6 rebounds that season. Do you remember that first game versus Hawaii? And what comes to mind in general when you think about that first year at OSU?
I don't know if it was Hawaii. The game that really stood out was the game against Arizona, because they had a guy by the name of Bob Elliott, who was an All-American candidate. I know it was one of my first games. I ended up killing him. Once again, that's when people realized that, okay, wait a minute, this little kid, skinny kid, can score. When you're going up against college players for the first time, and you're going up against a guy who's a potential All-American, and then when you play against them, you find out that, okay, well, they're all right, but they're not better than me. So that gives you a lot of confidence to quickly acclimate to the college level from the high school level.
Now, your would-be sophomore season was derailed after just three games. What actually happened, and how difficult was it to sit out after such an encouraging freshman year?
Well, my foot had been bothering me, so I used it for an excuse to get out of practice. I told the coach my foot was bothering me. They said, well, run over to the infirmary and have them check it out. So I went over to the infirmary, and they x-rayed my foot, and they found out I had a stress fracture. And they said, well, we're going to have to sit you out 4 to 6 weeks. I said, no, I just want to get out of practice. I don't need you to sit me out for a month and a half. But they said, yeah, so you have a stress fracture. So they sat me out. And then when I came back, we were supposed to come back slowly. And then it was the third game of the season, and my foot was bothering me. And I went to the coach before the game, and I said, Coach, I think we ought to slow down. I think we're taking it too fast. And his response was, if that thing was going to break, it broke already. So I went and played. I think it was the start of the second half, came down, and I broke the fifth metatarsal. I remember the coach come walking out on the floor. He looked at me, and then he just said, get him up. He walked back to the bench. Luckily for me, you could play up to three games and get a red shirt.
Uh-huh.
So luckily it broke on my third game. I sat out that year basketball-wise, but I got that year back of eligibility. So that's why I ended up playing, be at Oregon State for 5 years, because I got an extra year.
I saw on Basketball Reference where it had you down as five seasons, and one of them was only three games. So very fortuitous that it happened, I guess, if it was going to happen before the cutoff to be able to get that extra year of eligibility. Now, in 1979, OSU went 18-10, and you earned a berth in the National Invitational Tournament before you lost a one-point decision to Nevada in round one. In that game, you had 22 points. You averaged a little over 18 points and 6 rebounds a game. How did you find that experience of the NIT in terms of quality of play from regular season, perhaps?
I don't remember much about it. The NIT, it's a tournament you play in when you don't make it to the big tournament.
Yeah.
So there's NCAA tournaments, and then there's NIT. So I really don't remember much about that particular tournament.
The following two seasons, you did make it to the NCAA tournament, and we'll get to that in just a moment. This is 1980 we're talking about. Your Beavers had a great season. They went 26-4. You won the Pac-10 championship before being upset in round two of the NCAA tournament, losing to Lamar, 81-77. You had a great game, 24 points and 18 rebounds, but fouled out late in the contest. And you also earned AP honorable mention for All-American, and averaged about 17 points and 7 boards a game. In terms of that season, how did it feel to be part of the big dance, the NCAA tournament?
Well, that was the year that I broke my foot. We got three players from the state of Oregon who ended up being a big part of our success moving forward. So that year, things really started to gel, and we could see that team had a lot of potential. So that first game in the tournament was a learning experience, and that set the path for us going into the next season.
Was one of those players Lester Connor?
I think Lester came the following year.
Okay.
And he was another crucial piece to that run our senior year.
Just before you started at OSU, Lonnie Shelton had just finished his career there and had gone pro. And then just after you had left OSU, AC Green was one of the guys that would then end up being on the team. So there's some great lineage there of just some of the NBA players from around that era that would become.
And then after AC was Gary Payton.
Exactly right. Yeah, GP. And what an achievement that is to be second all time in career scoring just behind Gary. Have you had much chance to associate with him in the decades that followed and reminisce about your respective careers with the Beavers?
Not a whole lot. We run into each other from time to time, but we really haven't seen each other that much or even talk about our scoring.
What was the most important thing for you when you look back at the stat sheet after a game or following a season in terms of the impact you wanted to have on a game?
Our team had probably the best passing teams in NCAA history. I played the low post, and of course, all the defenses were geared to stop me. And the thing that they feared most was my hook shot. So I knew how to set the guys up. We usually start the ball on the strong side and then reverse to me. So before the ball gets there, I'm already setting my guy up. And I know with our passing when it's going to be reversed and when it's going to get in the position for me. And when I turn around to post up, I knew I was going to get the ball when I needed it right away because we had such a great passing team. Our coach, he hated the bounce pass. He wanted crisp passes, and then my teammates would get me the ball when I needed it at that second before the double team comes.
The hook shot is basically a lost art in 2020. Back in the era that you're talking about, clearly Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Lew Alcindor before that was a big exponent and probably the most unstoppable shot in the history of the game. Was there other centers that were relying on a hook shot, or was it something that you developed as well that was more of a unique thing that was only among a few players at that time?
It was only a few players. I don't remember playing against anybody else that shot hook shots on me. But the interesting thing is, if you were to go back into the archives and look at pictures or videos of my college game, I shot hook shots because they gave me layups instead. And the reason why they gave me layups was because the hook shot is a non-defendable shot. In order to defend it, since I'm right-handed, I'm turning to my left, they have to overplay your left shoulder to keep you from turning. And if you catch the ball and start on the second hash mark on the right side, that's the optimum spot on the court to operate from because that's where your primary and secondary move was the most effective. They overplayed my shoulder so bad that when I turned, they would cut that off, but they were so far out of place, all I had to do was fake the drop step, and they would bite on that, and then you just come on back for the hook shot. Then against zones, I just always look for the holes. So even though I shot the hook shot, I scored the majority of my points off of layups because, once again, I already set them up before the ball got there. My teammates got me the ball.
It's great to hear the background of how you are. Approach the scoring side of things. I appreciate it. In your senior season, you had a fantastic season yourself and as a team. The Beavers went 26-2, and that included a streak of 7 straight games where you had 20 or more points. And you also equaled your career high of 38 points in a game against Washington. You were also the Pac-10 Player of the Year, and the AP selected you as the second team All-American choice. So fantastic all around. From a team perspective, you're Pac-10 champs again before a shock loss in round 2 of the 81 tournament against Rolando Blackman and Kansas State when he hit that famous baseline game winner with 2 seconds left. How do you look back on your senior season almost 4 decades on and I guess the disappointment of getting so close to advancing further in the tournament before Ro Blackman hit that dagger to end your season and your career?
First of all, it was a great season. We had a really good run. The team really played well as a unit. That loss, of course, yes, is a very, very bitter loss. That's something you never forget, even though I don't really think much about the details of it. You know, I analyzed it a long time ago as to why I felt we did not perform well in that game and also the year before. And I think for me, what it came down to, we had a great system as long as all of the pieces were clicking. If our outside shooting was on, then you could not double team me that quickly. And if I'm scoring, then you have to help. And that opens up the outside. So if all those pieces are clicking, you're fine. But what happens in the NCAA tournament, it really does become a player's game. And you will see somebody on that team basically put the team on their back and carry them. Ralph's system did not allow that to happen. He wasn't able to make adjustments in our offense to say, we're going to get this shot here for this guy here. And to make adjustments like that, you had to just keep running the offense. And like I said, in the NCAA tournaments and the playoffs, it becomes a player's game, and somebody has to put the team on his back and carry him. And you still got to do everything else, but that one player has got to really carry the team, and his system did not allow that to happen.
You left college with averages of 17.5 points and 6.8 boards a game in 116 games. And at one time, you held the record as the NCAA's all-time career leader in field goal percentage at almost 68%, which is outstanding. Do you recall how long that you actually owned that record for?
I owned it till, I think, last year.
I knew it was a long time, but I wasn't sure how long. It's only just so recently was overtaken by somebody else.
I've never seen the guy play. I need to look it up because I wanted to see, one, what type of shots he was making, because that was incredible to break that record, because I didn't think it would ever be broken. And the reason why I didn't think it would be broken, because it takes a good low post player and a good passing team in order to get those high percentage shots. And those two things don't exist anymore.
No.
I would be interested to see how he scored. Obviously, he was shooting a lot of layups, but I would like to see what their offensive sets were. Either way, that's just an incredible record. So I held it until last year.
Yeah, which is an incredible amount of time to hold that for numerous decades. From what I read, you elected to skip a majority of the postseason All-Star games after that senior season, but you did play in the 1981 Aloha Classic in Hawaii, and your West team, interestingly enough, was coached by none other than Ralph Miller, and it also included future NBA great Tom Chambers. What sort of memories do you have from the Aloha Classic and its importance to your future when the NBA draft was barely 2 months away?
The game itself does not really have that much impact because they've seen you play for the last 4 years. They know what your game is. So it's just really an opportunity for players to showcase their talent. And I don't remember much about the game. It was a trip to Hawaii to have fun. But at that point, they already know who you are. Because we were one of the top teams in the nation, we played at a high level the whole season. So they've already seen you against a good competition.
I read that Marty Blake, obviously the famous scout of the time for the NBA, had you ranked very highly amongst the available centers, of course, at that time as well. The Kansas City Kings would select you with a 7th overall pick in the 1981 NBA draft. Where were you on draft day, and how did it feel when you heard your name called?
I was there in New York.
Okay.
I think the draft was at the Hyatt. So I was there in New York for the draft.
Do you remember the feeling that came across you when you heard your name called? And what teams did you think that you possibly could have been going to based on the lead up to the draft and what you'd heard at that stage?
Well, I already knew that I was either going to go to Chicago or Kansas City because my agent represented me and Orlando Woolridge. I knew I was going to go to one of them. And I do remember when I got selected by Kansas City, my reaction was, where is Kansas City? And and what's exciting about Kansas City? I just kind of thought, oh, well, I'm in the NBA.
What was it like to live in Missouri for that period of time compared to having come from California?
It's in the Midwest, so it's in the middle part of the country. It's flat land. Nondescript.
Hmm.
I remember there was a hotel train there that was actually called the Drury Inn. That gives you an idea of the pace of Kansas City. There was one area in town, I think it was called Mission Hills, which per capita had one of the highest income averages in the country because a lot of the CEOs of some big companies lived. So there was one pocket that was uber wealthy. The rest of it was nice, quiet suburban and a bunch of open fields. The arena was built down in the stockyards where they slaughtered cows. So that gives you an idea of Kansas City.
Okay. Is that Kemper Arena you're referring to?
Yeah.
You signed with the Kings in early October of 1981. A few weeks later, you actually played an exhibition game versus Portland back at your old stomping ground in Oregon. How did that feel to return to Oregon as an NBA player this time?
I'm sure it felt good. I don't remember. You're bringing up stuff that I haven't thought about for a long time. Of course, I always look forward to going back home. So tell me, how did I play? I don't even remember.
Well, I'm not sure what your stats were on that game, but I've got a photo of you. I think you're playing in front of Michael Thompson, who was with the Blazers at that stage. And it's a photo of you in your Kansas uniform. I'll send it to you after we're done with the chat today. Some of the old photos that I uncovered, they're just great to see the older uniforms and see some of the great players back in the day doing their thing. Now, in terms of your rookie season with Kansas City, you had really strong numbers. You had almost 13 points and 6 rebounds a game in just over 22 minutes of contest. The team went 30-52. You played almost 3 seasons there in Kansas City, and you were coached by the great Cotton Fitzsimmons. In terms of either your rookie season or the time that you spent there in Kansas City, as far as on-court goes, what were a few of the things that stood out to you most?
Well, some would say at that point, I was not coachable. Me and Cotton Fitzsimmons bumped heads because his system, the center at Kansas City that I was taking over for was a guy by the name of Sam Lacy. And Sam Lacy was a great high post passer. And Cotton was put me on the high post. And I'm like, dude, I'm low post. I missed your 76% from the field. So what are you doing putting me on the low post? So he and I bumped heads the whole 2.5 years that I was there until he finally traded me away halfway through my third season.
Okay. So I was going to say, in that third season, yeah, you played the first 50 or so games with the Kings, and then mid-February they traded you to Chicago for Reggie Theus and I think a few other future picks. I guess you obviously were happy that the trade happened. What did you think about hearing the news that you were going to Chicago?
Well, Chicago, great city. When I got there, though, the team was horrible.
Mm.
I would say we had the all-crackhead team, and I won't name any names, but I would tell you we had the all-crackhead team. When I got there, they actually were like a 7-game winning streak, and then I think the rest of the season we won 3 games. So it wasn't a very pleasant experience, because what happens when you get traded, you find out by phone, and then you have 48 hours to report to your new team. So I remember when I got the call, and after I hung up, I was sitting in my living room there in Kansas City, and I just thought to myself, okay, I don't live here anymore, because during the off season, we always went back to Portland. So I knew that I was going to pack my bags and go to Chicago, but this was no longer my home. And then when I got to Chicago, I ended up staying at the downtown Hyatt for the rest of the year. So you're playing on a bad team. You get home after a 2-week road trip and you check back into the hotel and your family is still back in Kansas City. So that was my experience when I got traded to Chicago.
Not the greatest, obviously. And as you mentioned there, in the late 70s, early 80s, the NBA had a reputation of sorts for some drug use. And I'm sure that listeners of the podcast will certainly know a couple of players that you're probably referring to there in terms of the Bulls. I won't go any further than that, but the Bulls struggled to a 27-55 record in 1984. How did you find playing then under coach Kevin Lockery as opposed to Cotton Fitzsimmons?
He was an interesting guy. How would I describe him, his coaching? I don't know much about his X's and O's, but he was fun to play with that time. A story about Lockery. We were playing the Boston Celtics, and everybody back in this era knew about ML Carr, who was this big cheerleader on the bench. Talent-wise, mediocre, but big cheerleader. He was in the game, and he was harassing one of our guards, just all over him, harassing him. So Lockery called a timeout, and we came over to the side, and he drew up this play. He said, I'm going to call this play R for revenge. ML Carr was now guarding Quentin Daly, and Lockery told Quentin to fake the pass and turn and throw it off of ML's face. So we went out there, we ran the play, threw it off his face. Lockery sat on the bench laughing. And then another game, we were playing the Pistons, and we were playing Bill Laimbeer, and he has a reputation of flopping, dirty player. So Lockery says, timeout, timeout, timeout. All right, Steve, we're going to run R for you. He said, I want you to get down low, take your hook shot, fake, and turn and wipe the F out with your elbow. So I said, okay, I'm going to foul him. Now I get to do one for free. So went out there and ran the play, fake one-way turn, and busted him in the mouth with the elbow. And Locker is sitting on the bench just laughing. And I got one more Kevin Lockery story.
Yeah, please.
We're playing the Milwaukee Bucks. And they had Cindy Moncrief and, God, what was the other guard's name? Ron Brewer. And they were killing us at halftime. I mean, they were just killing us. So we go into halftime, and Lockery just goes off on us. He's out there saying, it's an effing circus out there. They're doing tricks on you. He said, all we ask is for 3 effing hours. 3 effing hours of effort, and you get in your effing Mercedes and drive the F away from here. That's all we asked for. So we went out in the second half, and we got blown out again. So that gives you a glimpse of Kevin Lockery's coaching style.
Yeah, okay, that's very interesting. I really appreciate these stories. Quite enlightening, to say the least. The 1985 season, obviously the season changed Chicago's future when some guy from North Carolina was drafted by the Bulls. The team's record improved to 38-44 with Michael Jordan, obviously rookie of the year in 85. You had your highest scoring game with the Bulls in a March game of 85 at Dallas. It had a 31-point outing in a 10-point win. What was it like with the introduction of Jordan to the Bulls, and how did you find his fitting into the team as a rookie, obviously as an up-and-coming star of the league for many years to come?
You know, growing up, playing on the West Coast, you would always hear these stories about these great players on the East Coast and how great they were compared to the West Coast. And then when you played against the East Coast guys, you find out they're not all that. I can say unequivocally, with Michael Jordan, there was absolutely no hype. And what made him so great is obviously he has the physical talents. He has a high basketball IQ. But also what he has is he has the most competitive fire of anyone that I've ever met or I've ever played against. I am very competitive, but I struggle to comprehend his level of competitiveness. And I got two examples that will illustrate that. So this is later on in his career, okay? You've won Player of the Year, MVP. You've won 3 national championships. What brings you back for championship number 4, 5, and 6, knowing you have to play 82 meaningless games? When I say they're meaningless, because if you don't win it all, it's a failure. So how do you motivate yourself? You're making $30 million a year off of your shoe contract alone back then. How do you motivate yourself to come back for number 4, 5, and 6? That is what separates him from a LeBron. Kobe's come the closest, but that's what separates him. A good story of his competitive drive is when we were in Chicago, we used to get into car races. And I got into a race with him on the highway there on Lakeshore Drive, actually. And I ended up beating him in the car race. And I had a Mercedes 450 SEL, and he had a BMW 633. So the next day at practice, he shows up with a brand new Corvette ZR1. He went out and bought a brand new car, shows up and said, let's go. I'm like, Mike, come on. This is ridiculous, okay? I hadn't seen him for a long time, but I saw him at his 50th birthday party. And when I walked up to him, the first thing he brought up all these years later was that race. So my experience of playing with him is he is by far the greatest player of all time. It doesn't matter if it's practice or a game, he had to win. He would not let practice in unless he had won. So getting him on the team, obviously, it was quite an experience. And we were like the Jackson 5, and he was Michael Jackson. And we were just the other ones.
That's incredible, that story about the car racing. Thanks for sharing it. The Bulls made it to the 85 playoffs, so this would have been your first taste of NBA postseason action. You took on the Milwaukee Bucks, and they defeated you guys 3-1. Do you remember much about the playoff run against the Bucks? And you mentioned playing against them earlier when Kevin Lockery went off at you guys about putting in some effort. How did you go come playoff time in terms of matching up against those guys?
Well, Well, you find out that the playoffs is a totally different game. It's much more physical. You're playing the same team over and over again. So you have to be able to execute on offense because they already know what you're going to do. And you're going to have to figure out a counter to what they counter you. There's no comparison between regular season and playoffs. Much more physical. And like I said, you're playing against someone who has time to scout you. They already know you. And you just have to execute and make adjustments. And Milwaukee was a much better and much, you know, more experienced team than we were. Because obviously our record is great. I think we came in eighth. So therefore, we're going to play the number one seed or something. So the odds were already stacked against you. But it was a good initial learning experience.
They were a fantastic team all throughout the 80s. The Bucks, they were very, very much loaded. In mid-June of 85, the Bulls traded you to San Antonio for Gene Banks and a couple of second-round picks. Were you aware that you were on the trading block? And do you actually recall how you first heard that you were heading to San Antonio?
Yes, I do. So a friend of mine was a factory driver for the Ford racing team in the Trans Am series, and he had just raced in Portland. And the next race was in Detroit, and he had a big, giant 40-foot motorhome that he needed to get back to Detroit. And so I volunteered to drive it back for him. And so I was driving across country, and I stopped at a rest stop, and I was fixing myself some hot dogs in this big motorhome, watching the draft, when it was announced that I was traded to the San Antonio Spurs. And when I heard it, it didn't make sense because Cotton Fitzsimmons was the coach at San Antonio. I was like, I hate that guy. He hates me. What the hell is he doing trading back for me? The way that came about was during my time at Chicago, the assistant coach, Fred Carter, took me under his wing when I got there. Steve, he says, you got a lot of talent, but he says your reputation is that you're not very coachable. And one of our number one objectives this year is to change people's perception of you. And then we're also going to work on your game and to develop your game. He says, I don't think you're a center. I think you're a power forward, so I'm going to work with you. So he worked with me that year, both mentally and about the game and the game itself. And I credit him from turning my career around. So Cotton got the new Steve Johnson. He got the new improved. And Cotton had gotten smart, too, because he was training for me to come play the low post.
Ah, excellent. Well, I was going to say, how was your relationship with him second time round? But it sounds like he understood the value of you down in the low post versus the high post, as you talked about earlier. In that one season with the Spurs, you averaged almost 14 points and over six boards a game. And you led the league in field goal percentage, which is obviously an outstanding achievement, 63.2%. The Spurs went 35-47. They made the playoffs, and then you lost out in round one to the Lakers. Overall, for that one season that you were in San Antonio, how did you rate your time there?
It started out well, but about halfway through the season, I started developing problems with my ankles, with bone spurs, and that would be an issue for me the remainder of my career and follow me to this day. I think I finished the season on the bench because it had gotten so bad. But I enjoyed my time there with Cotton, got a chance to play with the Iceman and Artis Gilmore. So overall, it was a good season, but I ended up with problems with my ankles, and I was also going into a free agent year. So that wasn't a very good end to a season.
No, not ideal. Speaking of, in June of 86, the Spurs traded you to Portland for Larry Krzyzkowiak and Michael Thompson, who we talked about a little bit earlier. How did it feel to be leaving the Spurs and heading back to Portland, obviously an area that you're very familiar with, given your links back to Oregon State?
I always wanted to play for the Blazers at some point, but I didn't want to play for them as long as my father-in-law was there. So my father-in-law was Stu Inman, the original player personnel director and GM for the Blazers. So he's the one that put together the championship team. And if I were to play for Portland, he would be the one responsible for bringing me there. And I didn't want that pressure.
Uh-huh.
And so, fortunately, he left the Blazers that year to go help start the Miami Heat. The Blazers then traded for me. So, obviously, it was great coming back to Oregon. And you know, my wife was from there also. That was our home during the offseason. So, it was great getting back to Portland.
Yeah, that's great. Did not know that link about Stu Inman. There you go. You learn something new every day. Now, in 1987, you had a great season. You averaged almost 17 points and over 7 rebounds a game in not even 30 minutes of contest. The Blazers went 49-33, And you had a career-high 40-point game at Cleveland, including 10 rebounds in a late November game. This was also the season, unfortunately, where Sam Bowie would play just 5 games after suffering that terrible broken leg. And he also missed most of the following season, if not the whole season, from memory. We'll get to the 1988 All-Star nod shortly. But do you consider that 87 season to be the best of your career? Where would you put that if you had to rank it?
No, it definitely was my best year. Sam's misfortune was my break, not to use a pun there. Because when I got to Portland, I was really excited about playing with the Blazers because I looked at the team. And remember in Chicago, I'd been moved to power forward. But teams still put their centers on me. When I got to Portland, I was excited because they had a 7-foot center in Sam Bowie, who was a great passing center. So I'm figuring I'm going to play with a great passing center. I have the low posts. You have great outside shooting with Kiki Vandeweghe, Clyde Drexler, Terry Porter. You have Jerome Kersey, also at small forward. So I'm like, this team fits me to a T. But the start of the year, they had Kenny Carr at power forward. And I was having a hard time getting the minutes. And then I remember when Sam broke his leg, one of my first thought was like, dang, we got to find a center, trade for a center. And then I looked around, I was like, shoot, it's me.
It's you.
For the first 2 weeks, I literally sulked because I didn't want to play center. I want to play power forward. But after about 2 weeks, I went and talked to the coach. I said, you know, coach, I said, I don't think I'm a center, but I can do a better job than I'm doing. I'm going to give you 110%. And so he put me in the starting lineup. From then, I had my best year. And then the following year, it started out the same way. But those problems with my ankles were creeping back up again.
And obviously, through terrible injury to Sam Bowie, it led to you having to be put right in the middle and have a fantastic season yourself individually. In 1988, it was obviously a bittersweet season for you. You're riding high on the back of the previous year, and you'd also be named an NBA All-Star. From what I've read, it was terrible timing in terms of a thumb-related injury that saw you miss the All-Star game in Chicago. In terms of the season itself, your Blazers went 53-29, but you only played 43 games for the year and you missed the playoffs altogether due to the various injuries, I can only assume. Do you mind just talking about the highs and lows of that season and how it felt to get the All-Star recognition only to miss the game due to injury?
It was a big honor because when I spoke earlier, I had 5 goals that I set in 9th grade. The first one was to get to public school from the private school so I can get discovered, so I can get a scholarship. Goal number 2, once I got a scholarship and go to college, I was going to become an All-American. And then goal number 4, I was going to be a first-round draft pick. And goal number 5, I was going to become an All-Star. So that achieved my final goal that I set in 9th grade. I struggled with my ankles because the bone spurs were growing back, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to finish the season. And ironically, my thumb was broken by Lonnie Shelton.
Oh.
The move that players would do when people were hand-checking you and you would rip the ball through and knock their hand away, well, I was swiping up as he was ripping through.
Oh.
And so he broke my thumb right there on the pad of the thumb, so you couldn't grip. It was an honor to be selected, but yeah, it was a big disappointment that I wasn't able to play.
Do you remember much about the day itself? Most people listening to this would have probably seen the 88 All-Star game in some respects and see the starting lineup introductions you were mentioned, and you walk out onto the court, introduced, I think, by Tommy Edwards. How did it feel to walk out back on a court where you had played a few years prior and then knowing that you had to sit on the bench and watch all these All-Stars in action? Does that sort of eat away at you to this day, or is it something that you've learned to obviously have accepted at the time?
Well, you're disappointed, but it's still an honor to be there and to be recognized. And of course, these guys, you play against them on a regular basis. But when you're in this locker room with the guys that were selected as the top ones, I don't care who the players are. When you're in that type of company, everyone still feels humbled and honored to be part of that group. So it was a very special experience. And so I tried to just, you know, take it all in, even though it was a disappointment that I couldn't play.
I really appreciate you sharing these stories and your memories, Steve. It's great to hear this. Now, in 1989, Rick Adelman would eventually take over as coach from Mike Shula. I think he was an assistant for the time that Mike was the head coach. Your Blazers were in transition and then ended up going 39-43, and you averaged about 10 points and 5 rebounds in about 20 minutes a night. You got bounced in the playoffs by the LA Lakers in round 1. What was that third and final season in Portland like for you before everything was all said and done?
Painful, because once again, my feet are identical twins. I've had 14 surgeries.
Wow.
I've had 7 surgeries on each one for the exact same problem. And the bone spurs were on the end of the tibia and the top of the talus, which means every time you dorsiflex forward, you would hit the spur. The spur would grow and you'd start losing range of motion. It would wear away the cartilage. And so I think I was on my 2nd surgery on both of them by that time. It was painful season. And I knew that there was a chance that I would be left exposed in the expansion draft. And that's what ended up happening. At the end of the year, I was exposed in the expansion draft.
How did you compare and contrast Mike Shula as a coach to Rick Adelman in terms of their philosophies and what they were trying to achieve, bigger picture?
Well, there's actually 2 Mike Shulers. There was the first year he was a coach. He was a great players coach. He would put us in our offensive systems, but in terms of the decision about what to do, he would always say, well, if the guy does this, I'm going to do that. Should I do this? And he would say, I can't tell you that. Because what he was saying is, you have to make that call. Well, he ended up coach of the year. And then he came back the next year. And I think that meant so much to him that all of a sudden he turned into super coach, where he was studying the VCR and he was trying to micromanage everything. And so the second year, he went from being coach of the year to the second year getting fired. Adelman was assistant coach, former player, and he was a good coach. He understood that it was a player's game. The coach puts players in the right position to be successful, but the players have to make the decision. So first year, Mike, yes. Second year, no. But Rick Adelman, great coach, because he understood it's a player's game.
Now, as you mentioned about the expansion draft, mid-June of 89, the Minnesota Timberwolves, a new expansion team, selected you to join their franchise. You'd only played 4 games with the Timberwolves before being traded to Seattle for Brad Sellers in February of 1990. And then you played 21 games with the Sonics. How difficult was that 1990 season for you to go from Portland to Minnesota to Seattle, trying to find your spot back in the league?
Very difficult year. It says I played 4 games, but I literally played 18 minutes for them. The coach was Bill Musselman, who was a total idiot. He had no basketball knowledge. And also, the day of the expansion draft, I got a call from my old friend, Cod Fitzsimmons, and Chicago was trying to put together a trade for me.
Oh.
It would have been perfect because, problem with my ankles, once I get warmed up, I can play all right. But if I got to sit, there's a problem. And Phoenix, warm weather, he said, we'll start you. We'll bring Mark West off the bench after that. It was like a great thing, but Minnesota wouldn't make the trade. So I held out. I said, I'm not going. So I held out for 2 months. And then when I went back there, obviously there was a lot of friction. And it finally came to head one day. And I told them, trade me. I'm not going to play for this guy. And they ended up trading me at the trading deadline to Seattle. And I played the rest of the season with Seattle.
I did notice in your game log, actually, for Minnesota, that over the course of about the 2 months that you had those 4 separate games, and as you said, totaling maybe 18 minutes, there must have been obviously something going on there. So clearly it was not a great experience for you in Minnesota. The time you spent in Seattle, how did that compare? In those 21 games, you averaged about 6 points and a couple of rebounds a game in only about 11 or 12 minutes a night. What was that like to close out the 1990 season at least?
Well, it was funny. The players in Minnesota, they nicknamed me Noriega, because you're probably too young, but when Noriega was in Panama and when the U.S. finally turned on him, they were trying to get him out of there, and he was holed up in his compound, and they were blasting him with music, trying to get him to come out. So I held out, and when I got there, they nicknamed me Noriega. Okay. And so then, of course, getting to Seattle, I was set free. So the season didn't matter that much. It was just good to get out of Minnesota.
Understandable. In late October of 1990, you would sign as an unrestricted free agent with the Golden State Warriors, and you played 24 games there with them before injuries again started to...
ankles, bone spurs, they're back.
That's almost where it got to the point where you had to really consider your future strongly. In what would be your final season in the NBA, at what point did you sort of think, no, my days here are at this highest level are basically over?
Well, one thing about playing in the league, you're always in pain. You're dealing with inflammation because of all that pounding, but you're always dealing with pain. And then for me, actually going back to San Antonio when the bone spurs started. I played the rest of my career like playing on two sprained ankles. So the only way you can get through it is you have to play mental games. And so I would just tell myself, pain is my friend. I embrace it. You can do that as long as you're contributing. But when you're not a vital part of the team and you're not contributing mentally, you cannot deal with the pain. So that final year, when Coach Nelson called me into his hotel, we were playing in Atlanta, to tell me that they were releasing me, I was like, thank God, what took you so long? I wasn't going to quit, but I knew at that point that just physically I couldn't do it, and I was in too much pain. And so at that point, I already knew that it was over.
Just briefly, you were on the roster that included the famed run TMC, Tim Hardaway, Mitch Richmond, Chris Mullen. What was it like to witness those guys scoring almost a combined 70, 80 points a night, being a part of the run and gun team that the Warriors were at that stage?
I really enjoyed my time when I was there because I really loved those guys. Those three guys, they were great offensively, but they also worked hard. These guys were gym rats. Whether we were practicing or not, those guys were in the gym all the time. It was a really fun group of young players to be around. I say Timmy was the first crossover guy who had the real crossover dribble, not the ones where you palm the ball and carry it over. He was the one that had that quick crossover. And so I have really fond memories of my time there with them because they were a great group to play with.
I'm pleased to hear that. Now, in terms of post-NBA, what opportunities maybe presented themselves in terms of possibly playing either overseas or somewhere domestically within the States?
I looked at it briefly and had my agent look into it, but at the end of the day, I knew I needed another surgery to remove the bone spurs again. After all those surgeries, ankles were shot. There really was nothing left in the ankle, so we just called it quits.
I've read with interest in July of 1991, you managed to make it to a reunion game for former Oregon State players, and you scored 25 points, including a three-pointer, it said in the article, for Ralph Miller's Gold team in a reunion game. Does that ring any bells at all or not?
I'm thinking back, I'm like, wow. Maybe I should have played another year. No.
Evan got a long-range bomb as well.
That would tell me nobody was playing any defense.
It's funny what you can find on newspapers.com when you do some research. I just want to quickly go through a brief list of some of your accolades. It's been great to chat with you for this period of time. I really appreciate the time you've afforded me today. Since retiring from the NBA, you were inducted into the OSU Athletic Hall of Fame in 1993, the State of Oregon Hall of Fame in 1995. You had your number 33 jersey retired by OSU during the 1997 season, and you were added to the Pac-12, as it's now known, Conference Hall of Honor in 2007. When you look back on some of those achievements, and I haven't listed them all, but where do you sit with that recognition all these years on?
Well, obviously, it's an honor to be awarded those. As a player, you never think about those things. To this day, I really don't have too many pictures from when I played because I didn't think about collecting anything. So you play the game because you love it, and you play until your joints run out. And anyone that's any good, what makes you stop is you wear out your joints. But then to be able to look back on your body of work and to be recognized is obviously a great honor.
You got some great achievements there, and I haven't even gone through all of them. Basketball Digest had a regular feature which was called The Game I'll Never Forget. Is there one game from your career that stands out more than any other? We may have even covered it already.
Probably the Washington game that you referenced when I scored 38. We were ranked number one in the nation at the time, and we were down the whole game. We were down by two with like 8 seconds to go. There's a jump ball, and Ray Bloom ended up getting the ball and laid it up, missed. I tapped it in, went to overtime. Also that game, I think I shot 16 free throws in a row, which I wasn't a very good free throw shooter, I'm mediocre. So that game, it was a big comeback. I think I had like 8 points in the first half, too. And Coach Miller said I was playing like crap.
Do you have any particular significance to the jersey numbers that you wore throughout your career? It was mostly number 33. You did mention Lou Alcindor earlier, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I'm not sure if that's the reason. But aside from wearing 32 in Chicago, for the majority of your career, you rocked number 33 college as well. What significance is there to 33, may I ask?
Kareem.
It is Kareem.
Yeah.
Were you intimidated the first time you got to play against him? When people talk about the greatest of all time, no one really says Kareem, but given his achievements overall, it's hard to not think that he is the greatest of all time.
The scouting report on him was guard him tough, but don't get him mad. So give him 28, but don't go off for 40. But if you play too physical, play too hard and piss him off, you might go off for 40 or 50. So, you know, it was great playing against your childhood idol. And like I said, if he scores 30 on you, that's Kareem. He does that to everybody.
In terms of your involvement with basketball today, how involved are you? I know that you're heavily into your yachting and boating interests. What keeps you going these days, Steve?
I don't really follow basketball or sports that much. I'm now an old geezer, and so I talk like an old geezer. The game obviously has changed. It's just not relevant to me. The work that I do, online publishing and digital marketing in the yachting industry, I spend all my time online, but I spend all my time focusing on the stuff that we write about and our clients. So I don't really have any hobbies. I work with a lot of freelancers around the world. I communicate with them like I communicate with you, Skype. And so I'm online all the time, but I rarely watch sports and I rarely look at anything else but what I do.
Steve, it's been fantastic to have you on the show. I really appreciate the amount of time that you've given me and talked about your memories of your life in basketball. Thanks for making yourself available, and I wish you all the best for the future.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. You can suggest topics or guests you want to hear conversations with. Send me an email, audio clips are welcome, inallairness@gmail.com. Time to share another great review from a fan of the show. Thanks to HeavyD22, I'm confident that's not his real name, via Apple Podcasts Australia. It's titled A Blast from the Past and it's rated 5 stars. Thank you. And it reads, Hi Adam, I really enjoy the work you are doing. The discussions with those fringe NBA players are so well researched and reminds us that even the last man on the bench has an amazing story about his basketball journey. Keep doing what you're doing. Heavy D, you may know me as your MJ book supplier. I do indeed. Duncan, thank you very much, mate. Much appreciated. Duncan is a mate of mine in Sydney, in the same state here of Australia, New South Wales, about a 5 or 6 hour drive south from where I am here. Thank you, Duncan. Really appreciate your support, mate, and the books that you've sent me over the journey. Worldwide, the show has 168 ratings on Apple Podcasts with an average of 4.5 stars, with 90 reviews across all providers. Thanks for your continued support. If you add a review, I'd love to read it out on a future episode. Your ratings and reviews are one of the best ways to support the podcast. If you enjoy the show, please tell your basketball-loving friends about it. As I do like to say, your word-of-mouth recommendations are truly worth their weight in gold. Stay up to date with my podcast and subscribe to my monthly email newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming podcast episodes, future high-profile guests to appear on the show, and much more. Simply email me, inallairness@gmail.com. You can subscribe to my show in various ways. Search for In All Airness, 3 words, on your podcast app of choice. The show is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Android, and more. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show and share my web address with your friends and colleagues, inallairness.com. Check out the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with high-profile guests. Follow me on Twitter at InAllAirness. Please add your like to the show's social hub, facebook.com/InAllAirness. Join me next time for another edition of the show.